This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in. If you ask Americans to name the most important rights within the U.S. Constitution, they'll probably say free speech, maybe freedom of religion, and the right to vote. But the U.S. Constitution doesn't actually confer the right to vote, at least explicitly. Professor Rick Hassan of the UCLA Law School, who is one of the nation's preeminent election law experts, thinks we need a constitutional amendment to add the right to vote to the Constitution. He's the curator of the Indispensable Election Law blog, the director of the UCLA Safeguarding Democracy Project, and the author of a new book titled A Real Right to Vote: How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. Rick, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
It's so great to be with you, Josh.
So first, the entire premise of your book is that the U.S. Constitution doesn't affirmatively protect the right to vote, something I, of course, know as a voting rights professor, but maybe that'll surprise many of our listeners. So why doesn't the Constitution confer the right to vote?
I think the answer goes back to the age of the Constitution. Remember, the Constitution goes back to the 1780s. At that time, there wasn't a belief in universal suffrage. Under the original Constitution, voters didn't have the right to vote for president. They didn't have the right to vote for Senate. We didn't get that till the beginning of the 20th century in the 17th Amendment. And as to the House of Representatives, it said there would be elections, but it said that states would get to set the rules. So early on, there was no right to vote put in the Constitution. The words right to vote don't even appear until after the Civil War, and they're generally phrased in the negative. If you're going to hold an election, don't discriminate on the basis of race or on the basis of sex, but no affirmative right to vote, and that has lots of repercussions even for today.
Yeah, and of course, the topic that is the subject of most amendments is the right to vote, but as you noted, all those amendments phrase it in the negative. No state may deny the right to vote on a certain basis. In the book, you write that we need to, quote, play offense instead of defense on the right to vote. What do you mean by that?
So if you look at the structure of how voting rights get expanded in this country, it generally happens in two ways. One way is through there being limits placed on who's allowed to vote. And then the response is to try to sue over those limits. I would call that's like, you know, you're going on the defense. The state starts on the offense by limiting voting rights. This goes back to 1874 when a woman named Virginia Minor went to the Supreme Court seeking to fight against her disenfranchisement as a woman in the Missouri Constitution, and she lost. It's Jackson Giles, a man who was a citizen and resident of Alabama, who was denied the right to register to vote in Alabama, despite the 15th Amendment, which prohibits discrimination in voting on the basis of race. He lost, despite the language of the 15th Amendment. So defense is essentially, trying to fight voting restrictions in court. And as you well know, Josh, from your own studies, the U.S. Supreme Court and from your great upcoming book, we'll see lots of examples of this. The U.S. Supreme Court is not the great protector of voting rights. In fact, you look at the 235-year history of the Supreme Court, I think we can count only about an eight-year period in the 1960s when the court was actually leading on voting rights. So to go on the offensive is to do like what happened in the 19th Amendment, where women, after losing in the Supreme Court, organized and passed a constitutional amendment that barred discrimination in voting on the basis of sex. So what we need to do is think broadly about how can we expand voting rights so that we have protection for everyone.
Yeah, and as you know, many people think of the Supreme Court as a protector of rights in general, and it has been in some instances, but certainly on the right to vote, it has a pretty sorry history historically and more recently. And thanks for the shout out of my book that goes into some of those case law from the past 50 years. So your book, A Real Right to Vote, offers a proposal for a basic constitutional amendment with six parts. Walk us through the basic proposal.
So the idea is that some of the best protection we have for voting rights came from a set of Supreme Court rulings in the 1960s during the period of the Warren Court that read the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment as protecting certain voting rights. I'm concerned that these precedents in the hands of the current very conservative Supreme Court are not so steady. So at the beginning, I just try to codify those by saying that you can't discriminate in voting if someone is a citizen, adult, resident, non-felon, that people have the right to vote for all the offices in which where they are resident, and that includes for president. That would be changing Article 2 of the Constitution, which gives state legislatures the power to set the rules for conducting presidential elections. As recently as the year 2000 in the Bush versus Gore case that ended the dispute over the 2000 presidential election, the Supreme Court said state legislatures could take back that power at any time in future elections. It would also have equal weighting of votes. This is another one of those Warren Court precedents, the one person, one vote rule, also not contained in the text of the Constitution. I would also change the way that courts balance the burdens on voters against state interests, requiring the states come forward with real substantial evidence that when they're trying to restrict voting or registration, they have a very good reason to do so. I would also codify a part of the Voting Rights Act, commonly known as Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which provides that minority voters should have the same opportunity as others to participate in the political process, to elect representatives of their choice. I would make it clear that Congress has broad powers to enforce voting rights. And finally, I would set up a system where all voters would have to be automatic, if they're eligible, would have to be automatically registered to vote. And we'd have a kind of system of national ID so that all voters could be identified. So if you move from, say, Kentucky to California, your number would go with you, and we could assure that people are not registered to vote or voting in two different places.
I want to bring out three things from your proposal that you just mentioned that I think are really important to emphasize. The first is that although the U.S. Constitution does not explicitly protect the right to vote, there's case law under the Equal Protection Clause. And so your proposal, as you said, is trying to put that case law on more solid footing in the Constitution. The second thing you pointed out is that the current court has been way too protective of states' rights in running elections and really allowing states to justify burdens on the right to vote without a lot of evidence. And then the third thing you say is this this kind of compromise of automatic voter registration, which already occurs in a handful of states, with a national voter ID. I think that's a compromise politically, right? You're trying to basically get Democrats and Republicans on board with things that each of them like. Tell us a little bit more about that kind of compromise.
Well, you know, one of the things that I start a real right to vote with, and that carries me through, is looking how other democracies conduct their elections. So in most other democracies, if you think about modern democracies like Canada or Germany, in their constitution, they guarantee the right to vote. So, you know, I'll say all citizens over the age of 18. And in addition to that, all voters are automatically registered by the government. And the kind of automatic voter registration I'm talking about is broader than what states do, like my state of California, where you're going to be registered to vote if you have a driver's license, if you're eligible, unless you affirmatively decline. The state would have to proactively go out and find those voters who don't drive and would have to do more. But states, other countries also have national identity cards. And so if you were able to get rid of fights up in the states about voter registration and about voter ID, you'd eliminate a ton of the litigation that occurs around every election. You know, we are not normal as a country. Most other countries, even though they're polarized, they're not having lawsuit after lawsuit over what the rules are for conducting elections. Now, most of those countries have national nonpartisan election administrators. I've given up on that. That is something that back in a 2012 book called The Voting Wars, I advocated. But the local control is so strong here that I don't think we're going to change. And so I'm looking for a compromise. I'm looking for something that appeals to both voter access and concerns about election integrity. I don't think voter fraud is a major problem in this country, but it's enough of an issue that why not come up with a system that assures people, gives them confidence without having, you know, a way of undermining people's ability to be able to actually vote. So you marry these two things. You put the burden on the state to come forward with what all whatever the costs are to help verify that someone is who the person says they are, and then register them to vote, and it'll be registered for life. And when someone graduates from high school, they're going to automatically be added to the rolls, and they'll have that with them for their entire life.
You then go bolder, suggesting an amendment that would also tackle the Electoral College, the allocation of two U.S. senators per state, which obviously, you know, your state of California has two, and the very small state of Wyoming also has two senators, saying that both practices, the Electoral College and the Senate allocation, skew democracy. So which approach is better? And should we go all for broke and try to get it all? Or is the basic proposal the one that's more likely? And so that's what we should advocate for.
So I'm not a political activist. You know, I can only give kind of the ideas. And I think that really the question is, if we're going to have a movement to actually try to amend the Constitution and make voting rights central, what the scope of that is going to be up to the people who do that. And what I'm offering is a kind of menu. Here are the things that ideally I personally would put into a constitutional right to vote. But I recognize that some parts are more controversial than others, so I've carved them out so that you wouldn't necessarily have to include them. I think it really depends on whether or not there's the potential for movement towards getting some bipartisan buy-in on such a right to vote amendment. And let me talk about that, because lots of times when I'm speaking about this proposal, the first response is, well, it's never going to happen. Democrats can't even pass voting rights legislation. How are you going to get bipartisan agreement? And I have two answers to that. One is, I'm writing for a longer time horizon. If you think about the time between 1874, when the Supreme Court decided Minor versus Happersett and said that women did not have a right to vote protected under the 14th Amendment, and 1920, when the 19th Amendment was passed and ratified, that period of time, that's four decades. That's how we have to think. So we don't know what things are going to look like in upcoming decades. The other point is that as the Republican Party is changing, and as it is appealing more to poorer, less educated working class voters, the kinds of voting restrictions that some states put in place are more likely to disenfranchise these voters. So there may be a moment where it is in the political interest of both parties to broadly protect voting rights. And if the parties actually care about voter access and care about election integrity, there's something in it for both of them. I can't tell you exactly where that compromise might be. And so I'm laying out the various ways of thinking about, you know, how broad a scope that amendment could go.
So you note that a right to vote amendment could also reduce election litigation. Now, of course, you know, election law, election litigation keeps people like you and me in business in terms of what we get to talk about. But you know, lowering the amount of litigation surely would be better for the country. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, why a right to vote amendment would reduce litigation and why that would be beneficial?
So in the period since the 2000 election, the amount of election litigation in this country has nearly tripled. This litigation is partly the product of state-by-state legislation trying to change the voting rules, often to try and obtain partisan advantage. I'm not sure that it does, but it certainly creates uncertainty. That can create conditions where voters' confidence in the process is lowered. I mean, there's just lots of reasons to worry that the confidence in the election system, as it decreases, actually hurts our democracy. You look at polling about how many Republicans believe that the last election was stolen. It's very concerning, especially because I think that despite the difficult conditions of the pandemic, the last election was maybe the best run presidential election we've had in this country. And so there's, you know, there's a real concern about voter confidence. And litigation, in addition to changing the rules and making it hard for voters to know what the rules are and making it harder for election officials to know, it can undermine people's confidence. We should have clear rules. The thumb should be on the scale favoring voters. But we have to have safeguards in place, as every state does to more or less degree, to assure that our system is not going to be open to manipulation, whether that's by voters, by election officials, or by someone else. And so I'm looking to try to lower the heat, make things more rational, make things both more secure, and provide greater voter access and equality.
So you wrote the book, as you said, for a longer term horizon, you know, 40 years, perhaps, when there might be a political moment where an amendment could pass. What should we do this year, legislatively or otherwise, to make sure the 2024 election goes off without a hitch?
Well, first, let me say that it's not as though I'm writing it so that nothing should happen for the next 40 years. I'm saying it's going to be a long-term movement that may take mm-hmm. that long. And I actually, you know, I relied in part on your work, Josh, about state constitutions. So one of the things that we know is that every state's got a right to vote amendment in their state constitution. A lot of those were changed in the period between 1874 and 1920. A lot of those right to vote amendments were changed to guarantee women the right to vote as part of a political movement. Because we have such a decentralized system, we could see that again. So some, as you well know from your own research, some state constitutional protections for the right to vote are read very broadly, providing more protection for voters, but many are not. Many are not seen as any broader than the protections in the U.S. Constitution. And so we can think about action state by state. And so when we talk about election reform, it can happen at the local level. It can happen at the state level. And in terms of 2024, because things are so decentralized, there is so much that can be done. If you want to be a poll worker or you want to be an election observer, you want to work with a political party or with a, you know, a good government group like the League of Women Voters, there are just a lot of opportunities to assure that the 2024 election is going to be fairly conducted and voters have access to be able to vote if they are eligible.
So are you optimistic about voting in elections? You know, as you know from my work and our conversations, I tend to be the optimist in the room when we're at election law conferences. What about you? Are you optimistic? And how do we stay optimistic during this time of kind of doom and gloom swirling our democracy?
I don't think I would use the word optimistic, but what I would say is that I'm determined I think what we saw in the threats to elections over the last few election cycles is that people are no longer taking for granted that we will have a functioning democracy, that we'll have peaceful transitions of power, that elections will be fairly run. And so that's a call for activism. That's a call for people to ensure that we continue to have a strong and functioning democracy. And so when people are paying attention, they're more likely not to have their rights taken away, and they're more likely to advocate for strengthening those rights. So I look ahead to the future, and I think that especially when I speak to my students, when I speak to young people, they're concerned about the future. They're concerned about the future of American democracy. And with this book, I'm trying to give them some tools to think about how we can make things better for the future.
Let's dive into that answer a little bit more to ask this kind of fundamental question. Why should people vote? What's the point? I mean, you know, Republicans in your state of California, Democrats in my state of Kentucky, you know, who we sort of know who's going to win those states in the presidential election. So why bother voting in the first place?
Well, aside from the fact that it is one of the powers that we the people have to help to choose our leaders, we're not just choosing a president. You know, if you live in a local area, you might have much more influence, not over who the president's going to be, but who's going to be on your city council, who's going to be on your county board of supervisors, or in your state representatives. These people make decisions that affect all of our lives, and they are responsive to what voters want. This is one of the things that we know, is that politicians want to be reelected. They want their policies to be put in place. They want the support of voters. And so we shouldn't think of this as only about the U.S. presidential election. That, of course, gets so much more attention than everything else. But we're voting. We in the United States vote on more offices than anywhere else in the world. I mean, we just have so many elections. And that means there's lots of room to be able to have a voice in who is going to help to govern us.
Rick Hasson is a professor of law and the author of the new book, A Real Right to Vote: How a Constitutional Amendment Can Safeguard American Democracy. Rick, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
It was great to speak with you.
Josh, I think most people assume that voting is a right that's enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, but it seems it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, you know, we spoke with Rick Hassin about how the U.S. Constitution does not explicitly confer a constitutional right to vote, although there is case law that protects it, and Rick's proposal is trying to make that case law into a constitutional amendment. But as he mentioned, every state has its own constitution, and virtually every one of them does explicitly grant the right to vote. In fact, 49 of the 50 state constitutions include language saying that citizens are qualified voters or are entitled to vote. The only state's constitution that does not explicitly confer the right to vote is Arizona's, but its state's courts have construed its state constitution as protecting voters. So we can say that all 50 state constitutions safeguard the right to vote. In addition, about half of the state constitutions have a clause saying that elections shall be free, free and equal, or free and open. Several state courts have relied on those clauses to strike down partisan gerrymanders or other laws that harm voters, although other state courts have narrowly interpreted their state constitutions in a way that fails to protect voters. I wrote about these state constitutional clauses in a scholarly article about a decade ago titled The Right to Vote Under State Constitutions, and I've just followed up that article with a new scholarly paper titled The Power of the Electorate Under State Constitutions. In it, I look more holistically at all 50 state constitutions to highlight how they actually have many parts that protect voters. I identify what I call a multi-layered right to vote under state constitutions. I then argue that state courts should invoke this multi-layered right to vote to strike down laws that make it harder for the electorate to participate in elections. I think Rick is correct that we need a constitutional amendment to better safeguard the right to vote within the U.S. Constitution, but we also shouldn't overlook the fact that state constitutions already protect voters. We just need to convince judges to use those clauses in a way that promotes democracy.
Rick proposes an amendment to the Constitution. How many amendments are there?
There's currently 27. If his amendment were ratified, it would be the 28th. And in fact, the story of the 27th Amendment is pretty interesting. That amendment regulates congressional pay, saying that any salary raise for members of Congress will not take effect until the next election. This way, members of Congress can't directly give themselves a raise. In 1789, James Madison proposed this amendment along with 11 others. Each of these were passed by a two-thirds vote of the House and Senate as required, but not all were ratified by the required three-quarters of the states. 10 were ratified in 1791. Those are your familiar federal Bill of Rights. At the same time, only 6 states had ratified what would become the 27th Amendment. The amendment lost traction back then and largely fell into obscurity. But it was resurrected in 1982 by an unlikely individual. Gregory Watson, a University of Texas sophomore, stumbled upon the forgotten amendment while researching for a paper for his government class. He received a C on that paper, which ignited Watson's passion for the cause. As he told an NPR reporter, "I thought right then and there, I'm going to get that thing ratified." He contacted lawmakers all over the country. Maine Senator William Cohen responded and helped convince Maine legislators to ratify the amendment in 1983, which then sparked a nationwide movement. By 1992, after over 202 years, the necessary 38 states had ratified the amendment, leading to its official inclusion in the U.S. Constitution. As Watson put it, "I wanted to demonstrate that one extremely dedicated, extremely vocal, energetic person could push this through. I think I demonstrated that." His professor who gave him the C also felt some remorse after Watson successfully lobbied enough state legislatures to ratify the amendment. In 2017, 35 years after receiving the C, the professor signed a form to officially change Watson's grade to an A.
Oh, that's great. And Josh, you always ask your guests this question, so I'll ask you, what's one thing we can do to support democracy?
I think it's important for every American to know more about the U.S. Constitution. The National Constitution Center has a great online Constitution 101 course with videos on all aspects of the Constitution. I particularly like the 13th module on the right to vote. Check it out at the National Constitution Center's website, constitutioncenter.org.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.